Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. We are live in the green space this morning. Thanks, first of all, to Bridget Bergen for filling in yesterday while I was off for Yom Kippur. That's the day when Jews atone for our sins. Judging from my Twitter, I should have taken weeks to atone for my sins, but we only get a day, so I did what I could. Kind of related, let me start for just a minute today before we get to our first guest with a little poll for you here in the Green Space audience. How many of you have heard about the Ellen DeGeneres, George W. Bush, Dallas Cowboys controversy? About half, maybe even a little less. Well, apparently, when she was at the Dallas Cowboys game over the weekend and posted a video of her sitting in the owner's box and laughing it up with another guest there, former President George W. Bush, some progressive fans of Ellen on Twitter didn't like it. And Ellen responded on her various media.
People were upset. They thought, why is a gay Hollywood liberal sitting next to a conservative Republican president? Didn't even notice I'm holding the brand new iPhone 11. And but a lot of people were mad, and they did what people do when they're mad. They tweet. And but here's one tweet that I loved. This person says, Ellen and George Bush together makes me have faith in America again. And here's the thing. I'm friends with George Bush. In fact, I'm friends with a lot of people who don't share the same beliefs that I have. We're all different, and I think that we've forgotten that that's okay that we're all different. When I say be kind to one another, I don't mean only the people that think the same way that you do. I mean be kind to everyone. Doesn't matter.
Okay, green space. Now wait, don't applaud yet. Don't applaud yet, because we're going to take a poll. First, we'll ignore Ellen's little product placement there. But how many of you, and I'll assume that this audience in Lower Manhattan is heavily politically liberal, how many of you could pal around with George W. Bush, given all that he has done that you find awful? Applaud if you could. Applaud if you couldn't. Applaud if you didn't applaud and you don't want to admit that you really either could, or how many of you think less of Ellen for doing so? Just a few. How many of you think you couldn't have palled around with George W. Bush before, but now that Trump has been in office for 3 years, you're perfectly happy to pal around with George W. Bush? There we go. I knew we would find common ground. Listeners in Radioland, when we're here live in the green space, you can watch the show as well as listen, as we can stream live video from here. So come see us at WNYC.org or thegreenspace.org or the WNYC Facebook page. Now, whistleblowers are in the news, right? The Trump-Ukraine ones, obviously, and also Christopher Wiley. If you don't know that name, he is the Cambridge Analytica whistleblower whose revelations about that right-wing data mining company and its relationship with Facebook have changed the global conversation about political dirty tricks and privacy in the social media age. Now, Christopher Wiley has written a book with a one-word title that I can almost say on the radio. It's the word mind, followed by the letter F, then an asterisk, then the letters C and K. The subtitle, which I can't say on the radio, is Cambridge Analytica and the Plot to Break America. Christopher Wiley, thanks for coming to the Green Space.
Thanks for having me.
And I thought we might start by building this around a few vocabulary terms for our listeners. So first, what is psychographic micro-targeting?
So if you think about the word demographic, right, these are often things that you can see on a person, right? So a person's age, gender or gender presentation, their income, socioeconomic status. The term psychographic is a reference to a way of grouping people rather than by age or gender or race, etc., by behaviors, by attitudes, and by disposition. So it's like demographics, but for inside of your head. Micro-targeting is where you take large data sets about specific individual people, and you build a model, a statistical model, an algorithm, to predict characteristics about people in that data set.
So what was your role in developing a system of analyzing voter behavior based on psychographics rather than demographics for Cambridge Analytica?
Yeah, so you know, one of the things that I talk about in the book, which I think a lot of people sort of missed when the story came out, was that when I first got recruited at the company that later became Cambridge Analytica, I was actually working at a British military contractor based in London, which specialized in what's an area called information operations and psychological operations. And the work that I originally started doing when I was at this company called SCL Group was looking at essentially characteristics of people using data online to identify what are the characteristics of people who would be more vulnerable to radicalization online, who were more vulnerable to being exploited by groups. You know, this at the time, this was around 2013, so ISIS mm-hmm. was just emerging, and mm-hmm. there was a problem, particularly in Europe, about, you know, people in the West, what the military called the YUMs, young unmarried men, being targeted by extremist groups, recruited and, you know, going to Syria, et cetera. So when you look at sort of modern security threats, you know, like you've got the military in the United States, and it has this giant budget, and it's run by generals who are like boys with toys, so they love things that explode and are large and phallic. But when you actually look at modern security threats for Western democracies, right, it is, you know, it's all emerging online. And so when I started, we were looking at how to identify for, you know, national security purposes, people who could become radicalized. Mm-hmm. That company, SCL Group, you know, caught the attention of a guy who many people have now heard of, Steve Bannon. And, you know, he convinced an alt-right billionaire, Robert Mercer, to go and acquire the company. And the reason why they wanted to acquire the company was because when you create tools to identify and study and, you know, understand people who are more prone to radicalization, these young unmarried men who have particular kinds of psychological characteristics, more prone to paranoid ideation, for example, you can take that knowledge and you can invert it. And so what happened was when the company got acquired and they rebranded it as Cambridge Analytica, moved a lot of its operations to the United States, it was still looking to identify people who would be more vulnerable to exploitation and radicalization. But rather than to mitigate the problem, it was to amplify those characteristics and those attributes and radicalize people for the alt-right.
Instead of scaring them away from being radicalized by groups like ISIS, trying to lure them into being radicalized
for
by
the
alt-right groups in the United States.
Yeah. And one of the things that, you know, I try to communicate in the book is that, you know, I very specifically use terms like extremist groups in the United States, radicalization, you know, religious and ethnic conflict. These are words that often in the United States people will use to talk about, you know, Africa or other parts of the world when it is literally happening here.
Yeah.
And that I think it's really important for people to start realizing that, like, the alt-right is a radicalized group. And once you start to understand it that way, it makes a lot more sense.
Don't psychographics and demographics massively overlap? If you're, let's say, a white Christian, non-college educated male, 55 years old, laid off from a factory job, that's a demographic, maybe even a stereotype, the way I just articulated it. But that tells us a lot about what your political psychology and values, what you might call psychographics, are going to be, don't they?
Yes and no. So, you know, people. So just to be clear, like, people's behavior and attitudes are the product of an interaction between their disposition, so psychological attributes, and culture and environmental circumstances and demographics. So it is an interaction. There is no one single thing that determines your behavior. But I would say that, you know, if we walked out onto the street right now and polled, you know, 100, you know, young women between, you know, 18 and 24 who have, you know, an undergraduate degree, who live in New York, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, you know, are they the same person, right? They're not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just because they're all young women doesn't mean that they have the same experiences, that they think in the same way. This is, you know, an idea in, you know, feminist theory called intersectionalism. And so it's not to say that, you know, a person's experience, as you were talking about, isn't influential in their worldview. But like when you're looking at things like a person's, how prone is somebody to, you know, racialized thinking, you can have racists who are like wealthy and suburban. You can have racists that are, you know, of any kinds of, you know, life circumstance, if you see what I mean.
Right. So they intersect to some degree with demographics and to some degree not.
Yeah. They're independent constructs that interact with each other.
My guest, if you're just joining us, is Christopher Wiley, sometimes known as the Cambridge Analytica whistleblower. He's got a new book about his experiences and also some warnings for the world and some recommendations for government regulation, too, that we'll get to. We haven't even touched yet on Facebook's role in all of this. The book is called Mind, F word, Cambridge Analytica and the Plot to Break America. And listeners on the radio, we can take some phone calls for him at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And audience here in the green space, raise your hands and we'll come around with microphones. Next vocabulary term. You worked with Steve Bannon, as you said, who was vice president at Cambridge Analytica at the time. And you say he believed in something called race realism. What is race realism?
Yeah, so this is one of the things that, you know, I actually learned about when, you know, after the company was acquired and became Cambridge Analytica, was that in the United States, there is this growing movement that, particularly online, about people who look at the world through a very racial lens. But, you know, in sort of modern America, when I say modern, as in the past sort of 20, 30 years, you know, to be called or accused of being a racist is like quite a thing to be accused of. And it results in social shunning and all of that, one would hope. But there are a group of people who, rather than trying to hide those views, start to embrace those views in the way that if you look at sort of the economic disparities, for example, between white Americans and African Americans, or you look at the incarceration rates of African Americans versus white Americans, and this is to explain a perspective, so I'm not mm-hmm. I'm not defending this, and there's a lot of logical flaws in it. But if you look at that and you go, so you've got all of these, you know, African Americans, and they're being locked up, they can't get a job, they're on welfare, and they've had all this time to get their act together. And then I take a look at all of these African countries taking our money, and, you know, maybe there is something to this idea of differences, fundamental differences in the race. In races, and maybe that I'm not racist, maybe I'm just being realistic about race, and I'm not giving in to, you know, the PC warriors or the social justice warriors, etc., who are trying to limit my understanding and my language so that this group that they can milk votes off of, you know, is protected in our civil discourse.
So race realism is, I guess, a newish term for really the most old-fashioned, retrograde kind of genetic white supremacy.
Yeah, it is, you know, it's just a rebranding. And when you go and online and you read, you know, forums on 8chan or, you know, you name it, all of these sort of bizarre corners of the internet, you know, there are a lot of people who genuinely think that, like, you know, there are certain characteristics with that that are correlated to race. And the idea, and one of the things that I found so horrifying about what Cambridge Analytica ended up becoming was that it started to look for people who would be open to this idea that, you know, all of those, like, thoughts that, you know, glimmers of thoughts that you have when you watch a TV show or you see an African American or a Latino or whatever, and you kind of shut that down. You're like, no, I shouldn't say that. I shouldn't think that. Like, maybe there's something to that. Mm-hmm. Why don't we unpack that? Why don't we tease that out?
Giving them permission to go
and,
with
us. And it does give somebody, like, if you have these feelings, this idea that maybe you're the one who's living in reality and everyone else isn't, gives you permission to, like, embrace these inklings of thought.
So how well did you know Steve Bannon, and how much does he believe in, quote, race realism?
You know, he's an odd guy. I'm like, where do I begin? Read the book, talk all about it. But he, you know, one of the, he kind of sees himself as this, like, visionary. He wants to remake America, and he talks a lot about, like, a sort of very overly simplified view of, like, Hinduist scripture, for example, with Dharma, which is, like, the purpose or balance in the universe. And, you know, he likes to dabble in lots of thoughts from other, you know, other religions or other cultures, and collect bits and pieces in order to sort of create his, you know, or back his own sort of view of the world. And one of the things that he would often talk about is that, like, America no longer is America. And the only way that you can bring back America to a time where it had purpose, you know, it is to effectively isolate it first, so that once it's isolated from the world, then you can then work on remaking it from the inside. You know, he has a very odd view of what America should be, which is sort of go back to the 1950s. Where you could, you know, on one, he has this sort of vision of, like, suburbia in this way that was just perfect. But, you know, it's like, who is it perfect for, right? If, you know, sure, if you're, like, a white straight dude, that's great. You're living it up, right? But if you're kind of not that guy, life sucked.
So your crisis of conscience and your eventual whistleblowing came from seeing evidence of some kind of race realism project that Cambridge Analytica was going to do or was doing?
Yeah, so, you know, I remember, you know, seeing the products. You know, when you're looking at data or databases and records of things, it's quite sort of dissociating, because you know record ID number blah 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 blah, like, which had this response and, like, likes these things on Facebook, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Like, it's a bunch of data. Like, it doesn't look like a person, right? For me, when I started seeing, you know, video footage of, like, some of the focus groups that they started doing with those targets, or bringing people to events and footage from events where, like, you would literally, like, I watch these things and I see people who are just, like, so filled with rage about stuff, about these narratives that they had been fed. They did not know that they were fed this kind of narrative, but they were nonetheless fed these narratives that were completely made up about what America is becoming and who's trying to keep them down and who's trying to attack their way of being. And just the rage that you see in people's eyes for something that is literally Steve Bannon's fantasy. And I was just like, well, I can't say it on air, but, like, WTF, like, what, like, one of the problems is, like, if you're working at a company and your new management, like, has just taken over and they decide to do, like, grossly unethical or in some cases unlawful things, you can't just, like, go to HR and be like, can I just put on my record that, like, I disagree with this? Like, You can't.
You can't even go to HR if you've been sexually assaulted half the time and expect to get a good response.
For the record, I was not sexually assaulted by Steve Bannon. That would be really gross.
I didn't ask that question. By the way, you just said a word that you can't say on the radio. You can't even say the title of your book on the radio.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Mind, F word. Why did you call your book that, though?
So why did I call my book the thing that I can't say on air? The book whose title cannot be spoken. Because when I... So when I... When I was still working there, my friends at the time started noticing that I was kind of getting a bit cray and stressed out and like was quite different. You know, they would ask me like, okay, what is this? Like, what are you, what's wrong? What's happening? Explain it to me. And I'd be like, I don't even know where to begin. It's just a giant mind.
I like that. Did you practice that?
There we go. I can do sound effects. When I started working with The Guardian, in the very first conversation that I had with Carol Cadwalader, who's a journalist at The Guardian, which is a large newspaper in the UK, when she asked like what is Cambridge Analytica? Like, tell me, like, I've been talking to all these ex-employees and da da da, and I just go, it's a giant mind. And I say that both in terms of like, you know, when you read the book, because I talk a lot about all the really weird characters who were involved, who are like real people, like they're like in the White House and stuff, but like how weird they are and like crazy they are, and so it's super trippy. Like when you like read, when I was writing it, I was like, this is really trippy. But also, the very nature and purpose of the company was to like blank the minds of Americans. And so that's sort of why I chose it.
Let's take a phone call. And again, if you're just joining us, my guest is Christopher Wiley, known as the Cambridge Analytica whistleblower. And he's written a new book with that word we just didn't say on the radio that's about his experiences. We're going to go to line two. Stephanie in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Stephanie, thank you for calling in.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I am calling, I don't know if this is really more of a question or a comment, but I'm Chinese American and my brother is extremely conservative. And he, for years I've always said, like, you're racist, and he's always denied it. And he's basically said, I'm a race realist, I'm not a racist.
He used that term.
And he basically goes through everything that your guest just identified as Bannon's thinking. And my brother's a super intelligent, very well-read, well-informed person. So I have a lot of difficulty just making sense of how he espouses these views and refuses to acknowledge that there is a racist component. He believes in the like genetic inferiority of certain races and all these like things that are just atrocious to me. So I was really surprised to hear that your guest was saying that Steve Bannon espouses this race realism. I had never heard of that. I don't really follow much about Steve Bannon. So I guess my question would be, did Steve Bannon coin this or did he popularize it? Like, where exactly did it come from?
So a couple points. So one, no, Steve Bannon didn't invent race realism. It's an idea that's been around in various forms for like a really long time. It used to be called like scientific racism, or, you know, it was the underlying ideology of eugenics, in the sort of 20s and 30s. But it's a vehicle, it's a tool to help people rationalize underlying, feelings about other races. There's a whole host of, psychological biases that are at play with it, that are not related to intelligence. So you can be a highly intelligent racist. People often talk about racism, and we have this like concept of, you know, like the the like uneducated, you know, trashy person who, you know, doesn't know anything about the world and is just like, you know, spouting rage at different colors of people. But you can have somebody who is highly intelligent and still either hate or look upon different types of people with disdain. And, you know, it's not, the thing about racism too, is that it's not, and I actually talk about it in the book, it's not, you know, we often think about it as like overt hatred, but oftentimes racism appears in a much subtler form. And one of the things that Steve Bannon found interesting, particularly about Democrats, is that there's sort of a distinction between like this idea of liking groups of people and respecting groups of people. And one of the things that he kind of intuitively felt, and then later the company started exploring, is like, well, is there a form of racism amongst Democrats, amongst very progressive people, where, you know, you go like, I love African Americans, and you know they're great, but like we need to do everything for them, with the sort of underlying and not necessarily like consciously thought assumption that, you know, we need to build houses for them because they can't do it themselves. We need to do all the very paternalized, very paternalistic view of how to interact with different kinds of people. And, you know, that is a vehicle in as well to exploit. So it's not, racism can rear its heads regardless of intelligence, regardless of political spectrum. It's there in a lot of people.
Stephanie, can I just ask you, if you're still there, you said your brother uses that actual term, race realism. Do you have any indication of where he might have gotten it? Might have he gotten it from Facebook or from Fox News or any particular source?
No, I think I have no idea where he got it from. I do know that he has been conservative probably since college, but in high school, he was rebellious, cops. He was sort of like the opposite end.
Right, and I think we're losing you so much on the line for whatever reason that I'm going to go, but I think we get the gist. He doesn't know where that came from. But was this part of what you describe as Project Ripon, am I saying that right, in the book, one of the Cambridge Analytica projects that Steve Bannon was associated with that tried to foment these alt-right attitudes?
Yeah, it was called, I called it Ripon, but I got corrected a while ago by a member of Congress that I should pronounce it Ripon, because...
It's R-I-P-O-N.
Because... The origin, the reason why it was called Ripon or Ripon is there's a town in Wisconsin that where the Republican Party was founded. And so the genesis of the Republican Party was there, and this was to be the genesis of the new Republican Party.
Now, let me say that you see the deeper implication of Project Ripon not as simply the election of Donald Trump, but the ability to have a shared reality at all in the United States.
Yeah. So... You know, in the book, I don't just talk about sort of Cambridge Analytica. I end the book talking about more broadly, like, what did Cambridge Analytica exploit that still exists now with how we engage with the internet? And, you know, when I look at, you know, a platform like Facebook, Facebook often talks about itself. It uses sort of nice-sounding words, like it, you know, talks about itself as a community. Well, it's a gated community. And the reason I say that is because when you look at the very nature of like segmentation, right? The idea that you're going to take some kinds of ads and you're going to put it to group A and different kinds of ads to group B. And this has been a longstanding tactic in, you know, marketing, like, you know, this is toothpaste A for this person, that for that person, et cetera. But there's another word for segmentation that I use, and it's segregation. And the reason I say segregation is because when you look at, you know, how much we live our lives on platforms that are designed to segment us into different groups, what that does is if we now live you know, and get our news and get our information and talk to people, using an environment that is mediated by an algorithm that is trying to put us into different groups, separate groups, trying to constantly separate us and what we see, simply so that we click on it more, right? What that does is we go into the same platform, or we could be walking into the same theater, or we could be walking into the same building, but we're using different entrances. And our experience of that place, that community, is completely different. And when I go to Congress, one of the questions that I often get is like, what's the big deal about Facebook? Why is everybody like in such a fuss about it? It's just like ads. Like, who cares? Like, there's been ads forever, right? You know, you get a better deal or something that's more interesting. And one of the things that I say is like, well, what's the big deal about where you get to sit on the bus? What's the big deal about the water fountain that you use? What's the big deal about where you get to sit in the theater? That a really important thing about having a coherent, well-functioning society is like shared experience. And so if so much of our news, so much of our information, you know, these algorithms decide like which friends you should stay in touch with or not, right? Who does it think you'll be more engaged with? And so it will show you more of those person's updates than somebody else. You've literally, like, you have like a robot deciding whether or not you should lose touch with certain people.
So it moves us away from being able to have shared realities. We have a question here in the green space. Hi.
Hi. I'm curious to know. I'm curious to know what the sense and feeling was from your colleagues at Cambridge Analytica about the work that they were doing as well.
Yeah. So when we first got acquired, the team that was there, a lot of them were actually quite liberally minded. We had quite a few people who were, you know, immigrants, people of color, like you name it. It looks like a liberal spectrum of, you know, how you'd imagine it. A lot of people left. I was the first person to leave, but very shortly after, a lot of people left, and they were able to then sort of fill that void with people who were more chilled out about what the company was doing. But there were people who stayed. There were people who enjoyed it because you kind of, you feel powerful if you can figure out ways to get people to do stuff. And, you know, when shortly before I left is when, you know, we had a lot of interest from various Russian officials and Russian executives coming, you know, some of the psychologists that worked on the projects went to St. Petersburg in Russia and gave briefings on like, look at what you can do to American voters. Like, and like Facebook lets us do it. Isn't this crazy? You know, some of the people that they ended up, you know, hiring, like some are now indicted by Mueller, people who worked with, you know, ex-GRU agent, Russian intelligence agents, you know, and the whole thing to me just, it started spiraling out, like in a way that it was just, super trippy, and like half the time I was like, is this really happening? Like, are we meeting with people who like probably are like spies and they're like wanting to access our data in this country, and this is kind of really bleeped up?
Following up on the audience member's question, should I assume that the employees of Cambridge Analytica were or are overwhelmingly white? And as they
became that way.
That was really where I was going. They became that way because it wasn't always like that?
No. I mean, we had, you know, like one of my colleagues who I sat beside, she was, you know, a person of color, grew up, you know, in public housing, very liberally minded person. But, you know, a lot of these people joined before Steve Bannon took over. Like I left, and like there was a mass exodus of people who left probably about 3 months after I did, because there was a project in Nigeria that really, I think, tipped the scales, which I talk about also in the book, you know, where the company used the services of hackers, some of whom were like ex-Russian, ex-Israeli, et cetera, intelligence agents who were able to acquire the private email records of the now president of Nigeria, and then also created videos that I passed on to investigators. They were some of the most disturbing things I've ever seen. They took actual footage of people being tied up and having their throats cut, and it wasn't like acted out. Like there was actual, it was like real footage of it. There was one woman who was put in a cage and she was burned alive. And
in pursuit of what? Releasing these videos?
Well, in Nigeria, you have a Christian population and you have a Muslim population. And so if you are trying to divide a country, you present the Muslim population in a very particular light. And also, one of the things that the company did was target areas of Nigeria with these ads to depress turnout. I mean, it's voter suppression. And because, Nigeria, and they're doing it for, wealthy backers who wanted mineral rights and oil rights and stuff in the country and made a deal and and so they wanted to depress certain kinds of votes in certain regions, mm-hmm. and they did that through intimidation.
We're almost out of time, but still thinking about our first caller who identified herself as Chinese American and her brother conservative and subscribing to race realism, did you see evidence that they were trying to target Asian Americans in particular ways?
Yeah. Yeah, because one of the things that they sort of identified was if you frame America as like this sort of zero sum game where it's like if other people become successful, that means that you are less successful. You are able to like pitch people against each other, and also there's like quite a bit of latent racism within a lot of Asian American communities, particularly towards African Americans, that was exploited. Even things like narratives of like you're the hardworking immigrant and they're just on like welfare.
That explicit.
Yeah, you had to go through all the rules. You had to jump through all the hoops. You're the one who's the honorable person here. You're more American than this person because they're on welfare and they're taking your taxes. You had to work to get here. And that, when you listen to that, in particular, if you, imagine you are an Asian American immigrant where you've really struggled yourself and you've like worked, as hard as you can to like get a shop or get a store, or start a business or whatever, support your family. And like, there's something about hearing that just gets you. Like you just, people can fall into that.
Trying to exploit that as much as possible. We're already over our time, but I do want you at least to be able to give a very brief description of the policy recommendations you make in the book. You describe something as a building code for the internet. Is this mostly aimed at the role of Facebook and other social media in these recruiting efforts for the alt-right?
Yeah, so one of the, we've like literally relegated public discourse to a private company. You look at Facebook, it was a company started as a hot or not website because I guess Mark Zuckerberg couldn't get laid. And now our democracies around the world are being threatened because of that. And one of the things that I talk about at the end of the book is like all of the ways that Silicon Valley frames these debates that are like very subtle, but actually change people's perceptions of things in a way that I find really unhelpful. So, all this idea that is that, well, it's a free service. Like, if you don't like it, you don't have to use it, It's first of all, when you look at the top job titles at big tech companies, right? It's engineer and architect, right? These are architectures. They're not services, they're architectures. And they're architectures where you don't really have a substantive choice. You can't choose. If you want to have a job, you can't be like, I don't want to be tracked by Google. Like, you will have to use Google. You will have to use LinkedIn. If you want to have a functioning social life, you will have to use these platforms. Just in the same way that you have to use electricity. You can say, and we don't say, if you don't want to be electrocuted, don't use electricity. Right? And secondly, when we think about architectures, right, you know, we wouldn't allow an architect to build a building without fire exits, for example, and, you know, at the door have 20,000 words of terms and conditions in a little book, right? And the door says, when you push this door, you accept these terms and conditions. And if you don't like that you're trapped in a burning building without fire exits, we wouldn't allow the architect to go, well, it's in the terms and conditions. I was being upfront. It's transparent. If you didn't read it, that's your choice. It was free to enter the building. You know, we would say, why are we allowing architects to build burning buildings without fire exits? And so this is why I say, think about this as an architecture and think about how we regulate architectures. And I think that's a more helpful way to think about it.
And sorry to say, that's going to have to be the last word from Cambridge Analytica whistleblower Christopher Wiley. His new book is Mind, F-Word, Cambridge Analytica and the Plot to Break America. Thank you so much for coming to the Green Space.